Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices on San Francisco's historic Market Street. I'm Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club. We also welcome the listeners of KUBB-FM in Merced, California, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to visit us at our website at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's program. With a slew of presidential primaries just days away, the Commonwealth Club is very pleased to welcome our distinguished panel to discuss Election 2000. All four of our panelists are associated with the Brookings Institution. Founded in 1916 and located, of course, in Washington, D.C., Brookings works to improve the performance of American institutions by analyzing emerging public policy problems and offering practical remedies for them. Like the Commonwealth Club, Brookings is an educational nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve civic society in the United States. Our first panelist to my left is Ambassador Michael Armacost, president of the Brookings Institution. He has served as U.S. ambassador to both Japan and the Philippines, and his expertise encompasses U.S. foreign policy, national security, and trade policy. Welcome, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you.
Next to him is Thomas Mann, who is the W. Averill Harriman Senior Fellow in American Governance at Brookings. He has taught courses at Johns Hopkins University, Georgetown University, and the University of Virginia. His expertise is in campaign finance, election strategy and tactics, and he has a rich knowledge of campaign history and trends. Excuse me, Mr. Mann, I got you out of sequence there, but we're welcome, and we're glad to have you here. Thank you. Now I'll get back in line. And our third panelist is Bill Frenzel, who joined Brookings in 1991 as a guest scholar in the Governmental Studies program. He made this move after retiring from the U.S. House of Representatives, where he served his Minnesota constituency as a Republican for 20 years. He is an expert on international trade issues. Our welcome. Our final panelist, E.J. Dionne Jr., who is a nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, as well as a senior fellow at Brookings. His best-selling and influential book, Why Americans Hate Politics, was published in 1991. He is a regular, some say ubiquitous, commentator during the current political season. These days, he is focusing on how to build a civil society, particularly by involving churches and other non-governmental organizations. Welcome.
Thank you.
Our moderator today is Scott Schaefer, host of the California Report on KQED-FM, a weekly statewide news program carried by more than 20 public radio stations throughout California. He has an extensive background in both journalism and politics, having served as press secretary for former San Francisco Mayor Art Agnos. Now I will put today's program in the capable hands of Scott.
Thank you, Skip. Well, all four of you just returned or left Los Angeles, where you were watching the presidential debates. And I think I want to begin by asking you, Tom Mann, how did the candidates do? And did it change anything as we go into this final weekend before Super Tuesday?
Actually, I had the good fortune, along with Bill Frenzel and E.J. Dionne, to attend the Democratic convention, small audience, 100 people or so, and I have to tell you, we came away, Bill and I, impressed by the quality of the two gentlemen seeking the Democratic nomination and by the quality of the questions put by the citizens of Los Angeles. It was civil, it was substantive, it was informed. The one question, sadly only one question on foreign policy, was handled with subtlety and nuance in a way that should be very reassuring to the citizenry. Now, everyone made much of the fact that there were no fireworks between the candidates, that Bill Bradley was not on the attack. Well, yes, the reality is that The race seems largely resolved, and Bill Bradley has blissfully moved back to recapture the whole basis for his candidacy. And as a consequence, I thought he comported himself with dignity and eloquence. And for people watching on, it was quite informative. What you learned is that those two candidates, Al Gore and Bill Bradley, are very much alike on substantive policy issues. They differ in their temperaments, in their conceptions of presidential leadership, in their styles, and it probably is the case that Al Gore is better suited to the November election, the fall campaign, and to the presidency, but I think it was very reassuring. On the Republican side, it was somewhat bizarre as we had the disembodied voice and image of John McCain from St. Louis. It was testier. It was more spirited, certainly. George Bush was more comfortable when he was talking about an issue that he really has experience with, namely education policy. Less comfortable when he was answering questions about foreign policy. But again, the debate seemed to reinforce the current state of play, which is after this dramatic back and forth between these two major candidates, we now are once again at a position where Bush has moved into the lead, is strong in California, at least for the allocation of delegates, and the race is again approaching a possible near end point if Mr. Bush can be successful. But alas, this has been a year of many surprises for analysts. Good old citizens control the process ultimately, and they may tell us next Tuesday that this race is going on for a good long while.
EJ, what about you? Do you agree with Thomas Mann that we're approaching the end game here and that things will pretty well be decided by Tuesday?
I mean, it feels like that. I was watching the Democratic debate, and I thought Al Gore and Bill Bradley were like two prize fighters who climb into the ring and then announce they're Quakers. And then it was all kindliness and brotherhood after a month of really sharp attacks. And I think that may reflect what Tom said, which is, you know, certainly a lot of Bradley's advisors think his chances are very small. There's been a lot of talk that some wanted him to drop out of the race early. Funnily enough, I think whatever the reason, I think he actually helped himself in that debate because I think he reminded people who liked him in the first place why they liked him. There was a thoughtful quality there. And Gore, I think Gore showed that Bradley has improved him as a candidate. But I don't see that debate making much change except perhaps I think some people will come back to Bradley and they want to give him a vote just because of what they thought about him before. On the Republican side, what struck me briefly is that I think McCain has gotten off into issues that aren't helping his campaign as much as the core reform message. I think the more you talk about phone calls and push polling and going back and forth about who said what to whom on the telephone, it's harder for people to figure out who's the reformer. And I think that hurts him more than Bush because his is supposed to be the different kind of campaign. And I was struck, I thought that Bush last night didn't do a great job handling the gun control question, did do a great job on handling the education question, which is the one issue he has passion about. McCain, I think, sort of obviously had the advantage on the campaign reform back and forth. I mean, obviously, depending on your point of view, but I think it was his. He was more comfortable with the issue. But I think that for McCain, he's got to get the campaign back to this core argument about reform in the next few days.
Bill Frenzel, you served in Congress for 20 years as a Republican from Minnesota. What do you make of this internal fight, this sort of fight for the soul of the Republican Party? Is it something that is going to be seen down the road as just a blip, or are we looking at something more fundamental here?
I think it is both. I think there is a fundamental change from a very dominant role having been played by the so-called evangelical right over the past dozen years. And I think the primaries and the process have revealed that the public still wants the Republican Party to be a little broader than that. On the other hand, it is pretty clear that that group is going to continue to be very strong in the party. It may not be able to arm wrestle every other group in the party, but it will still be an important factor. I do not believe that the McCain and Bush forces will have difficulty reintegrating when a candidate is chosen. But I think it has been a very good exercise for the Republican Party. I'm a Bush supporter, and so I probably shouldn't like all these open primaries, but I think it is a very good thing for the party to have a mixed system in which some primaries are closed, some are open. I think the combination makes for excitement, and it forces the party to understand that its extreme 15% cannot control everything that the party does, or it will lose elections.
Do you think that McCain was speaking for a lot of Republicans who perhaps didn't have the courage or the platform to stand up and say that this is the party of Abraham Lincoln and Ronald Reagan and Teddy Roosevelt and not Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell? Or was that more of an act of desperation from a candidate who needed to turn out more Democrats and independents?
I had the same feeling that E.J. Dionne had, that is, that John McCain got off message because he had suffered in that South Carolina primary, and he was desperate to do something in Virginia. It seemed to me that was exactly the wrong place to take the anti-Falwell, anti-Robertson message, because they are Virginians, and there is some pride and loyalty there, even though you may not be a big fan of either man. I think in politics it's always been axiomatic that that you try to be nice to the people in your party on whom you're ultimately going to have to rely, and you can chide them a little bit, but scolding them openly is not a successful game in politics.
Assuming that McCain does not get the nomination, you want to speculate on the kind of reception he'll get when he goes back to work at the Senate?
Well, if you have observed him in the Senate, you will note that John is a kind of a free spirit anyway. And, you know, it turns out that he is really quite conservative personally. And so he is, in many respects, a soulmate with the majority of his colleagues. But he always does his own thing anyway, and my guess is that there will be no difference in the way that he treats his colleagues or his colleagues treat him. He's a good senator, and I, like you, am assuming that that he will go back to the Senate and he will render good and useful service to the country.
Mike Armacost, presidential campaigns in this country are basically long job interviews between the voters and the candidates. Do you think that the candidates are addressing the issues that need to be addressed, both in terms of what's going to be on the agenda for America in the 21st century and in terms of the kind of information voters need to make a good choice in November and in the primaries?
Well, I think foreign policy is the dog that isn't barking. Maybe one or two questions come up, but we all recall 4 years ago that Jim Lehrer had to practically coax a question out of one of the town meetings. And after the answer came in a rather perfunctory way, people went back to things of greater concern. It's not so surprising, I think, at a time when we're at peace with the world, that this set of issues isn't on the top of everybody's mind and isn't getting quite the same attention as domestic issues. But I recall that Woodrow Wilson, when he was embarking on a train ride from Princeton down to Washington for his first inaugural, said, "Wouldn't it be an irony of fate if my administration had to deal primarily with foreign affairs?" And, of course, that was precisely the irony that fate had in store for him and many of his successors. So it's too bad that the debate doesn't focus a little more on these questions, because they will clearly occupy whomever wins in this contest time after next January.
Well, and probably the foreign policy issue that has absorbed the most attention has to do with a six-year-old boy named Elian Gonzalez. How long are we going to be debating the Cuba policy of this country in the very black and white issue that it has been argued since the early 1960s?
The issue has been kind of hijacked by ethnic groups in this country. It's not the only issue of that kind. I think that's, in a way, more peripheral than the issues that I think should occupy the debate during the campaign. How do we get the relationship with the big powers straight? And I hope that will, in the contest between the parties, as November comes closer, be a little closer to the center of the discussion. It's not all bad, by the way, that people don't talk in extenso on this. I can recall candidates in the past have made commitments in campaigns that have come back to burden them later. I think President Carter committed himself to withdrawal of troops from Korea and had to work about 3 years to walk that one back. President Clinton in the last campaign described the Chinese government as the butchers of Beijing. Shortly thereafter, he was describing him as strategic partners. So sometimes on these issues, the kind of restraint that I think the candidates have shown, particularly on the China question recently, is admirable because language counts. People other than our own voters are listening in, and it's important to get some of those words straight.
Let's talk about this process, our primary process in the United States. It seems that each of the states have slightly different rules. In New Hampshire, they have one set of rules, South Carolina, another. Next week here in California is perhaps one of the most confusing set of rules in the country, where we have what is called a blanket primary, where anybody can vote for anybody, regardless of what party you're registered with, or whether you're even independent or declined to state, but only the votes of registered Republicans and Democrats will count toward the delegates for those parties. So we could end up, at least theoretically, with a situation where, say, John McCain gets more votes than George W. Bush in the beauty contest, but leaves California without a single delegate because the Republicans, unlike the Democrats in California, have a winner-take-all primary. Thomas Mann, is that a good situation for the United States to have so many, such a, you know, a quilt, patchwork quilt of rules throughout the country that I would think confuse a lot of voters?
Oh, I'm sure voters are confused by it. It's one of the costs of having a genuine federal system where certain responsibilities are retained by the states. And in this case, what we have in California is a conflict between the state law passed by initiative and national party rules, which require that at the very least when a citizen go into the voting place, they, if not registered with that party, that they request the ballot of that party as a statement of some kind of commitment to the political party, if only for the 10 minutes it takes them to fill out the ballot. But, of course, California's new law, the blanket primary, allows voters to jump back and forth between different parties for different offices on the ballot. And that violates both parties' conception of what it takes to participate in a primary. Some states have no party registration, and anyone can vote, as we saw in South Carolina and Michigan. But they have to go in and in the very process of requesting a ballot, in effect, make a statement for that particular party. Washington State has the same system, and so we have this bizarre count, by the way, with the absentee ballots that's still going on. It's going to take us a while to discover this. Listen, the only way around this is to nationalize the whole system, to say states will no longer choose how they will select delegates to national party conventions, but it will be set by national law.
Well, in fact, the National Secretaries of State Association has come up with a rotating regional primary system whereby, of course, New Hampshire and Iowa would still be first. But that there would be four regions, west, south, east, and is it northwest or north, I guess. But in any case, do you think, would that kind of primary where we have, it's not quite so front-loaded as it is now, and where there's maybe you give other parts of the country a chance to have more influence than they do currently?
I think there's something to be said for the system. The one advantage it would have is it would avoid the situation we experienced this year when we had a period from the New Hampshire primary to the Titanic Tuesday, next Tuesday, in which only the Republican Party had events. And with open primary rules, it meant there was an open invitation for Democrats and others to participate in what is essentially a Republican Party affair. It also meant all of the nation's attention was on the Republican battle, and it meant poor Bill Bradley had no opportunity to recover from his narrow loss in New Hampshire and get some attention. So the advantage, Scott, is that you would always have both parties holding events on the same day. It turns out that differential scheduling of events before Super Tuesday is more important than the front-loading phenomenon this time around.
E.J. Dionne, you wrote a book 9 years ago called Why Americans Hate Politics, in which you asserted that Americans are turned off when candidates avoid discussing what they perceive as the real issues, like health care and international trade. Instead they launch into these polarizing political diatribes that short-circuit real debate. And I'm wondering if you think Campaign 2000 has given American voters any reason to feel any better about politics in this country.
Well, actually, I think over the last 6 or 7 years, I think we moved a little ways away from some of the polarization I described in the book. I think it's very clear when you look at the effects of the Clinton presidency. On the one side, the impeachment really did polarize the country, and I think right now, deep down, the country is still polarized around Clinton. If you go to Democratic meetings, you hear either nice things about Clinton and the economy or certainly no attacks. If you go to Republican meetings, you are still reliving impeachment and all kinds of things about the Clinton administration. So in that sense, the polarization is still there. But when you look at this campaign, if you take on the Republican side, compare what George W. Bush says about government to what Ronald Reagan said. Ronald Reagan said government is not the solution, government is the problem. George Bush says things such as, government if necessary, but not necessarily government. That's a much more moderate statement. He's criticized his own party for acting as if no government is necessary at all. So I think that, so Bush and McCain, even though you had the polarization in South Carolina and a certain slipping to the right, or the appearance of slipping to the right by Bush, I think we actually have a more moderate discussion. The other thing is that in these primaries, you also have two very different discussions of issues going on in the two parties. On the Republican side, a whole lot of the discussion is about character and some of the social issues. On the Democratic side, the discussion is about health care, education, child care, and those sorts of issues, and some on Social Security. I think in the general election, we're going to move much more to an agenda that is like that list that's being discussed in the Democratic Party. And on some of them, Bush certainly wants education on the table, too. But I think we've moved away from some of the polarization. I just want to say one quick thing on the California ballot. Only a state with all those dot-com companies could invent a system where you have specially coded ballots counted in a special way to figure out how we get delegates to the convention. As a technical achievement, it's quite impressive.
Although here in San Francisco, we still count our ballots by hand. Bill Frenzel, talk a little bit about negative campaigning. John McCain and Bill Bradley got into this race and vowed that they were going to take the high road, that they were going to avoid personal attacks. And yet, as we've seen, not only have they turned to that as this campaign has unfolded, it seems to have, in some cases, worked for them, although we're now beginning to see perhaps a backlash against McCain for his attacks on evangelical Christians. But is negative campaigning just a part of politics, and is talking about getting rid of it just pie in the sky? And I know if we look back at politics going back hundreds of years ago, there was certainly negative campaigning in this country. Do we just have to get used to it?
In a nutshell, yes. But it's a more complicated subject than that. Politics, as they told me when I first started it, ain't beanbags. It's a contact sport. And many times the only way you can distinguish yourself from your opponent, particularly if you're a challenger, is to take on the record of the opponent and take it on very strongly. Because all of us who are incumbents describe our record in glowing terms, and you can always find something glowing about the sorriest record of an incumbent. And so it is up to challengers and to opponents to make the case and prove that they are different from their opponent and prove that their opponent at times may be mischaracterizing at least portions of their own program. I don't object to that at all. There was a time a few years ago when in the Congress there was a great movement to stop negative advertising by giving federal bounties to respond to them. And I thought that was just nonsense. Any incumbent believes that anyone who challenges his or her record is seditious. And that's, of course, absurd. It's a tough game. I believe that the negative campaigning reached its peak under what I would call the Gingrich period, where you had to use the so-called crunch issues that would move a Democrat to vote for a Republican or vice versa by picking items like guns and abortion and things that people feel very strongly about. I think both parties and all candidates have found that those are two-edged swords, that they move a tiny portion of the electorate, and doesn't mean they're going to abandon them. But I think in the future we're going to hear probably a little less about them. And I think the campaigns are going to look more normal to people of my age who can remember the good old days when we didn't stick our thumb in the opponent's eye at every opportunity.
I want to talk a little bit about campaign finance reform because it's been one of the cornerstones to McCain's campaign as well as Bradley's. And now, of course, Bush and Gore also say they're for it. John McCain stood up a couple weeks ago and said, Republicans are in the pocket of insurance companies and HMOs, and Democrats are in the pockets of the trial lawyers, and that's why nothing ever gets done on health care reform. Mike Armacosti's right, isn't he? Is that the way Washington works, that it's just interest groups with large campaign contributions really determining what can or can't happen? Or can we, within the system we have, actually make big changes that can really benefit consumers, the environment, school kids, and so on?
You've got people on the panel who spend a lot more of their waking hours on this issue than I do, but in my view, sure, lobbying groups are a powerful influence in Washington, but it really depends upon whether or not the citizenry is aroused by presidential leadership, whether or not the movement of groups who have an active interest in particular issues move toward a national consensus on that, or lock in the process while the public remains more or less outside and silent. So I think there is a capacity to manage the process with strong leadership and strong ideas, but that requires candidates themselves to articulate strong positions, and it requires them to mobilize the voters outside Washington on behalf of those views.
Thomas Mann, maybe you want to jump in and talk about campaign finance reform. People say they want campaign finance reform, but few people can seem to agree, and they don't seem to want public financing of campaigns. And I'm wondering what you think of McCain's characterization of, as he calls it, the Iron Triangle in Washington.
On the one hand, I'm pleased that Senator McCain has raised this issue, given it some visibility, demonstrated that when used almost as a metaphor for larger concerns about the way Washington works, it can energize the citizenry. That's the good part. The bad part is that in order to get the attention of the public, he has to exaggerate. He has to engage in a hyperbole. And he would have us pretend that if we banished private money in elections, we would enter the age of policy nirvana, in which our differences would disappear, we would live in a consensual era and do the obvious thing on all matters pertaining to health and education and the rest. James Madison wouldn't recognize that world. Listen, this is a big, sprawling country, diverse interest, contentious issues that are debated. Those very lobbying groups you talk about spend 8 or 10 times more money on traditional lobbying activities and efforts to advance their issues than they do on campaign finance. And therefore, eliminate the latter is still going to leave the former. This is not a simple matter, and no, we would not have an obvious solution to the patient's Bill of Rights issue if contributions from health maintenance organizations and trial lawyers were suddenly removed. Money makes things more difficult, and especially since we've entered the era of soft money. But the problem isn't so much nefarious special interests trying to ply their resources on politicians. It's politicians engaging in near extortion of private interest. I mean, politicians can play one interest off the other, and increasingly they're really, really heavy-handed in the way they go after 5- and 6- and 7-figure contributions from CEOs of companies, wealthy individuals, labor unions, and the rest. We need campaign finance reform to stop the kind of shakedowns, to return some legitimacy to our democratic process. But let's not overpromise that it's going to do away with the legitimate differences that exist in our society. It's still going to be tough, but money isn't buying votes. It's not quite the swamp that people suggest it is. And money is a problem in every democracy in the world. That's not a recipe for despair, for accepting the status quo, but it does suggest a little realism. Let's work at it. Let's plug some of the holes in this system. Let's have a system we can be prouder of, but let's not expect a grand new world of consensus.
Well, I'm going to begin weaving in some questions from the audience, and along those lines, someone is asking, how much will the recent conviction of Maria Shaw on campaign finance illegalities related to the 1996 Clinton-Gore reelection effort that was stemming from the infamous Buddhist temple event down in Los Angeles, how much will that affect Gore's reelection effort this fall? EJ?
I want to just add something to what Tom said, but the answer is the film of the event at the Buddhist temple, which will soon be released now that the trial is over and can be used in commercials by the Republicans in the fall, may have even more impact than this particular conviction. But this is, you know, this is a problem for Gore. I don't think there's any question about it. I think the problem for Gore is that it's easy enough to disentangle himself from the problems President Clinton had that led to the impeachment issue. That's Al Gore had nothing to do with that, certainly as far as anybody knows. Whereas this is something where he got involved. And, you know, the irony is campaign reform ought to be, in principle, a Democratic issue because Democrats have voted for it in Congress. They're the people who want to limit the power of money on government.
Although they haven't really voted for it when they could get it passed.
That's absolutely right. And I know I've written about this a lot. In fact, I thought the Democrats made a terrible gamble. Their gamble was they could use incumbency forever to raise money, and so they liked the old system without guarding themselves against the possibility that if they lost, a lot of interest groups who had only given to them when they were in power would be happy to give all their money to the Republicans. I want to just to something Tom said. Earl Long, the governor of Louisiana a long time ago, used to tell potential contributors that early money gets consideration and late money gets good government. And I think this problem has been with us a long time. And Robert Dahl, a political philosopher and political scientist, has wrote a book recently on democracy where he has two paradoxical chapters. One chapter says why a democracy can only exist under free market systems, and the next chapter was why free markets are a problem for democracy. And I think the dynamic here is that money in a capitalist society will always have ways of gaining influence. And that throughout our history, what we've tried to do is when we have gotten to the point where money had too great an influence in our politics, we wrote rules to restrict it on the grounds that you do not want government decisions dictated only by who has the most money to bring to the table. Teddy Roosevelt passed the first laws against direct corporate contributions back in 1906, and I think now we're in a crisis because campaigns have become so expensive, much more. Campaign costs have gone up, I think, even faster than college tuition costs and the cost of medical care. And so now we are at a point where money really is having too much influence on small issues, especially on tax bills that nobody notices. I think money can have an effect. And so we again need to have another period of reform where you put some constraints on this. And I think reform is a continuing process. One reform that never fixes anything forever. The Watergate reforms actually worked pretty well for a while, and then they stop working, and that's why there is this call for campaign reform.
One of the complaints that Dan Quayle and Lamar Alexander both had after they dropped out was the $1,000 individual campaign contribution limit, which they say, combined with the early primary front-loading, really killed them. Alexander, in fact, said, quote, under the system we've got, the media picks a winner, the fundraisers place their bets, the $1,000 limit runs everybody else out of the race, and it's all decided before Thanksgiving. Is he right about that, Thomas? Tommy?
I think it's too extreme an argument. I think Lamar Alexander and Dan Quayle's problems was not the contribution limit, although I would favor raising the contribution limit, at the very least to reflect the force of inflation, downward force on the real value of that contribution limit. Listen, all that money went to Governor Bush because there was an effort within the Republican Party to find someone who could win back the White House for the Republican Party. And the best idea seemed to be to pick one of those governors who were doing so well, and George W. Bush seemed to have a tremendous profile, a sort of famous name, someone who had been successful in a big state, was reelected overwhelmingly, attracted a broad base of support, who had tremendous retail politics skills, who was closely associated with the most important issue on the country's mind, education. It was a natural. And so everyone sort of rushed to give their money to them. It wasn't because the media anointed Governor Bush as the candidate. But he did basically absorb much of the resource base available, and that made it more difficult for Alexander and Quayle. But when you really come down to it, in my view, 9 months ago, there was one really plausible alternative to Bush. His name was John McCain. McCain had no special advantages in raising money. For a long while, he operated without very much money, and once he broke through, the money came to him.
Why wouldn't the others be plausible?
I just thought for a whole host of reasons in the early testing of their candidacies, and perhaps the testing didn't go on long enough. It would have been nice if they made it all the way to Iowa or New Hampshire. But none of them really seemed to sort of strike a chord with the broader electorate. I don't think anyone ever felt Steve Forbes really was presidential in character, and yet he had a bottomless pit of money. Elizabeth Dole seemed promising at the beginning, but no one could ever figure out what she was running for president for. She never really made a compelling case. And Dan Quayle was trying to resurrect an image destroyed, created perhaps unfairly many, many years ago. After all, he was a pretty good Republican senator when he was picked as George Bush's running mate. So I think for a variety of reasons, the other candidates fell short. The one who had a story to tell, a compelling case, and told it with verve and excitement, actually managed to overcome the money problem and make this a very competitive race.
Bill Frenzel, you wanted to say something.
I did. I wanted to stress something that Tom said much too diplomatically, and that is that money is part of the market test of a candidate. And if you are Dan Quayle or Lamar Alexander and you cannot get people to contribute to your campaign, it is because, probably, maybe because, not because they don't like you, but because they don't think you're going to make it. And they look at George Bush and they say, hey, this guy's got some possibilities. I'm going to bet on a winner. And so George Bush scoops up all the money. He doesn't unfairly take money from the other candidates. In my judgment, the American public is not required to support a dozen or a half a dozen candidates who aren't going to make it. And they shouldn't be required to do it with public money because they don't do it with their own private money that they contribute willingly. It is important to understand that money is part of the test of a candidate. I'd like to make one other thought here, too, that we're talking about lobbying and money earlier. And often people in politics use lobbies as a scapegoat for their own lousy programs or their own ineffective promotion of their own programs. And they say, well, the only reason I couldn't do that is because of big labor or big business or big anything else, and they spent more money than I did. And using the lobbying excuse has become the sort of the last recourse of scoundrels in the United States. Finally, I would say as far as money and individuals go, I had some colleagues who used to say, I cannot be bought at any price, but I can be rented on a short term.
Here's an audience question for Ambassador Armacost. Which of the candidates do you think could best deal with the big powers, Russia, China, et al.?
Well, I think actually we're in one of those fortuitous moments of our history where we're throwing up candidates of substantial substance and experience. In the case of these candidates, there's a fair amount of common ground, it seems to me, on the big issue. They all, I think, support strong national defense. They all support strong alliances in Europe and Asia. They all make an articulate defense of free trade. They all, I believe, recognize the importance of devoting special attention to China, which has acquired enormous power, but about which there is a lot of uncertainty as to how they'll use that power. So I think in the case of all the candidates, there's not only a fair amount of common ground, but there's a fair amount of experience. As Mr. Gore, by virtue of being vice president, has been deeply involved in the management of foreign affairs over the last 8 years. Mr. Bradley served on the Intelligence Committee for many years, and he was very instrumental in dealing in the Senate with issues that related both to international monetary issues and trade in particular. In Mr. McCain's case, he not only served for a lengthy period of time as a military officer, but has had long experience on the Foreign Affairs Committee in Congress and therefore has a fair amount of expertise on both foreign and defense issues. Mr. Bush, I suppose, is the least experienced, as one would expect, from governors. They don't conduct policy under our Constitution. But he's grown up in a family where there was a fair amount of preoccupation with these issues, and his father did extremely well. So I think in all cases, there is a pretty good chance that the Republic is in safe hands. And thinking back over the last 40 or 50 years, in most of our campaigns, in the back of people's minds, there was a kind of job qualification test as to whether or not the candidates had the right stuff to stand up for our allies and stand up to our adversaries. It was a kind of toughness issue. It wasn't so much an experience test. Otherwise, I don't think Jimmy Carter or perhaps Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton could ever have been elected. There wasn't that experience at the gubernatorial level. But it's a test of character and also the capacity to select people, surround yourself with people to help you form the critical judgment. So I feel I'm not going to say one over the other. I just express my own satisfaction that this is a pretty impressive field when it comes to handling these issues, either through personal experience or the people surrounding them.
As time goes by, it seems more likely we're going to have presidents who did not have any military experience themselves, as Clinton does not. How big a handicap is that for presidential candidates and ultimately for presidents?
Well, I think certainly during a time when we faced major adversaries abroad, it was a fairly important test to we're entering an unusual period of time in which we stand so predominant in the international ranks that there is a temptation perhaps to do things that maybe we should think twice or three times about. Our military power exceeds the combined weight, I suppose, of four or five next-ranking industrial power. Our economy is the engine of the global economy. Politically, we kind of set the agenda. And our popular culture is so strong that it's appealing to others even when they resent that fact. But it seems to me, therefore, there's a test for Americans as to whether we define our role in the world as exemplars in hopes that others will look at our society and find it so appealing they'll seek to emulate it, or we use that power, which far exceeds anyone else's, to try and impose our views on how things should work on others. And that's a kind of a new problem. For 50 years, we organized a global alliance against a fixed adversary. The adversary is gone. Now, in many ways, we face the typical problem of the greatest powers of the past, whether others will gang up on us. And it will require, I think, of our diplomacy that we sustain for others a recognition of the value they derive from our alliance and our relationships. And we'll have to define our role a little more modestly because, precisely, we have extraordinary power.
Scott, could I just say quickly, on that military experience question, it's interesting, this campaign, there are actually two of the four remaining leading candidates are both veterans of the Vietnam War, John McCain most famously, but also Al Gore. And what's going to be interesting to see is whether this issue of experience has anything to do with the campaign, if somehow the choice is between a veteran and a non-veteran. I think that we're going to have fewer and fewer military candidates with military experience praying that we do not have another big conflict because we ended the draft after the Vietnam War. So the only people who will be veterans will be military professionals.
Well, let's as we sit here near the epicenter of Silicon Valley and the technology revolution, let's talk a little bit about the Internet. Arizona this year has gotten approval to go ahead and use the Internet so that people there could vote, I think, in the primaries over the Internet from home or work. We had a task force here in California this year who said, not so fast. There are a lot of issues around fraud and security that need to be worked out first. Tom Mann, what are your thoughts about how technology has already changed our political system and what we might have in store for the future?
I think Internet voting is inevitable in this country, but it's going to take some time for it to become a normal, regular feature of our elections. It will likely unfold in the way we're seeing it this time with a test in the Arizona primary. We will begin to see Internet machines replacing regular polling machines, voting machines in polling places to ease the count and familiarize people with the equipment. And eventually you'll be able to go to any polling place, then community kiosks, schools, and eventually when the penetration of the Internet reaches all households and we don't have the problem of the digital divide and the unfamiliarity of many people, it will become much more commonplace. But it will take a long while. We saw the efforts of hackers to disrupt some important websites and e-commerce. We can't risk the legitimacy of our election counts to this kind of subversion, and so we're going to have to proceed very gradually. But Scott, in the meantime, the Internet is going to play an important role in another part of the elections, namely the campaigning. We saw it develop in the fundraising arena, certainly with Bill Bradley, but most dramatically with John McCain after his surprisingly large victory in New Hampshire. It's increasingly important as a way of candidates sort of posting their commercials, information, recruiting volunteers, sending emails to targeted lists. It's also extremely important to those who cover campaigns as a way of getting information on a timely basis. So it's rapidly changing the way we conduct our campaigns, cover them, and eventually it will even change the way we cast our ballot.
EJ, there's some thought that it could be a way, using the Internet to vote might be one way to get more young people to vote since they seem to be so Internet savvy. But there are others who say that as we move more in that direction, that the digital divide and people's lack of access to computers, those who are more poor, less educated, could in fact skew the electorate and who actually turns out to vote. If it's made much more easy for people who are people of means, people who are well educated, to vote via the internet.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the way I think about it is a system where everyone is treated fairly, except the person over here can just walk into the room to vote, and the person over here says, you have the right to vote, but you've got to climb 25 flights of stairs, and then you can get to the polling place. And in this case, the people with, with computers will have an easy time of voting. People who tend to be poor will be told you have to use the old-fashioned method. And so it'll skew, I mean, the concern, and this would obviously probably worry Democrats more than Republicans, but it worries anybody who cares about a fair system, the concern would be that you're going to skew the electorate, which is already somewhat skewed toward the top. Yeah, you'd skew it that way even more. So I do think that's a real concern, and it probably will take a while before the digital divide is closed, and so I think there'll have to be other ways of equalizing the system. But, you know, if you look at the literature on why people vote and why they don't, convenience is only a piece of it, and I think that people choose to stay away from the polls. It's always been true young people have voted less than older people, and the question is there dramatically less participation now? And I think those kinds of questions hang much more on what's happening in politics. Rules can help make it easier or harder, but I think it has much more to do with an attitude toward politics and the efficacy of politics and the obligations to participate than they do to share convenience.
Bill?
I would say election laws change very slowly, particularly at the federal level, but also at state levels, except perhaps in states that have initiative and referendum. But no matter how good the internet voting looks, the trade-offs between the security of the ballot and privacy of the ballot are going to be very, very difficult to resolve. They're going to be slow in coming. Second point, I wanted to amplify something Tom said about forgetting about balloting, but information and discussion on the net. It is said that in the election of the current governor of the state of Minnesota, in which he defeated two relatively strong, by local standards, candidates of the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, much of his success among the younger voters was achieved through the internet and various communications, including chat rooms and that sort of thing, on the internet. So I think we can the internet is going to be a factor in elections in a lot of ways that some of us old people don't understand at all and never will.
Here's another audience question, and I'll throw it up to whoever wants to answer. What is the single most important change you would make to reform our electoral process? Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Some form of campaign finance reform, and I am partial to, I think public financing done right works. It worked for a long time in the presidential elections. After Watergate, we instituted a partial public financing system. That system it worked pretty well until all the loopholes opened up, and I think you could do the same thing. Some way of getting free media time, and if the broadcasters can make a plausible case that this is unfair to them, you can give them a tax credit back for the time they have to give up. But I think somehow you don't want to simply cut the spending so you cut people's access to political speech, but I think you want some way to rectify this balance where private money, I think, is at this moment having too much influence.
Isn't there always going to be an advantage for individuals who are very wealthy who aren't going to be reined in by campaign finance reform unless the Supreme Court changes its mind on that?
There are ways. I mean, some people have proposed that if you're faced as a candidate with a mountain of spending by a self-financed candidate, the rules are loosened for your capacity to respond. I mean, you could try to do something like that. And I just want to emphasize, there's no way you'll ever eliminate the influence of money in politics in a free society. And at a certain point, I'm not sure you would want to totally eliminate the role of money for some of the reasons Bill said. But I think you definitely need to reduce its influence. And I think in this democracy, it's more out of hand than in a lot of others, though, as Mike could say from his experience abroad, there are some democracies that have had similar problems.
Scott, it's important to remember, too, the citizens' help in this regard. Self-finance candidates have done remarkably poorly, and especially in California elections. So Michael Huffington, Al Checkey, you know, it reminds us of that West Virginia governor's race when Arch Moore had, running against Jay Rockefeller, had bumper stickers that said, "Make them spend it all." there's a lot of money wasted by millionaires seeking their future in politics. I think it is possible. Having made the case that we exaggerate, the role of money, I would also say the highest priority of electoral reform is dealing with the soft money, sort of sham issue advocacy that so delegitimizes our electoral system and rules that it makes a whole lot of Americans come to believe that Washington just doesn't work. It does work better than they think, but they think better if we acted sort of modestly and responsibly in this arena.
And that's going to be the last word. This brings us to the conclusion of our program this afternoon. It's now my pleasure to turn the podium back to Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club, who will adjourn the program.
Our thanks to Michael Armacost, Thomas Mann, E.J. Dionne Jr., and Bill Frenzel of the Brookings Institution, and Scott Schaefer, host of the California Report on KQED Radio, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.